Hello, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And boy, paradigm shifting is really lifting heavy weights in this world. And a lot of you know about the 60s. We have a special being who was an activist in the 60s, and a lot of you are going to have heard of him. Welcome to Rennie Davis, who was one of the Group of Seven, and amongst the years before that, that was around 1968, I believe, Rennie. Before that, he's been an activist all the way through the 60s, and I'm so excited to see what happened after the 60s as well. So welcome to the show, Rennie.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I really look forward to this.
Me too. It's such an interesting time on the planet. And as you and I know, right now is probably one of the most exceptional times this civilization has undergone, at least in this particular incarnation, right?
You know, I have to say, in a way, every generation probably thinks that about itself. Certainly in the 60s thought itself as, you know, the greatest generation ever, and World War II has had, you know, but when you think about a future generation looking back on a time like the 60s or really any generation, it's pretty much always the same. You know, the future sees past generations as, you know, just another generation passing through the world like every previous generation. No one changed the world. Certainly in the eyes of evolution, no biggie, you know, just passing through like everybody else, you know.
I remember in the 60s, we wanted to change the world. We thought we were going to.
Yeah, I know, you know, but and I have to say, having said all that and understanding the big sweep of history in a sense, I think you're right. I think that if a future time was to look honestly at this time, then it would say this is a time like no other. And this is a generation that, well, what we do or fail to do in the present time is actually going to determine the outcome.
We're not
just passing through, that this is really the crossroads of humanity. And we really are at a moment like no other ever.
Yes, because part of it is the global networks and so on. But before we get into all that, I would really like you to share some of the adventures you went through in the 60s, because you were groundbreaking. And I don't know. I know every generation thinks they're the ones, but I think we really smashed open some of the frequencies or the vibrations that kept us locked in.
I really agree with that. You know, let's even back up a little bit from that and say, let's look at this rare social phenomena that actually has occurred in history, but is unusual, which is I'll call it a movement to change the world. It occurred in the Renaissance. It occurred in the American Revolution. It occurred in the 60s. And it has some properties that are really interesting. One is that just before it launches, everyone who's about to change the world is in the world, present. And yet they walk right by each other every single day, completely unaware of what they're about to do. You know, it was that way in the Renaissance. It was that way in the American Revolution. I mean, everybody was on the fence in the 13 colonies until Thomas Paine, you know, just ignited the fire of revolution with his common sense pamphlet. And I remember January 1960. I mean, you had millions and millions of people, most of them in their 20s, that were about to change the world. Yet there was no pundit at all who saw what was coming. And the people that were about to do it just walked right by each other, completely clueless of what they were about to do.
Or sitting at a counter drinking cherry Cokes or something, right?
Well, it was the same. It's in a way the same as today. Mm-hmm. Today, we're actually the largest movement in the history of the world. We're larger today than the Renaissance, the American Revolution, and the 60s combined. And we're all here at the starting gate. But
a lot of us in metaphysics feel like this is the time we were born into on purpose to make the difference. Is that right?
Well, you know, that would be probably pushing the envelope to say whether it's right or wrong. I'm kind of a person that likes to go inside and listen to questions like that. And what I get, and this is just me personally, is that this is a phenomena, these movements that do get created before we're born, that a critical group of people came in for the Renaissance, and same with the American Revolution, and same with the 60s. And it is absolutely what's up today. And so most people don't tune into themselves quite that way. But if you do, if you just be quiet and listen without an agenda, without your brain roaring, and just listen, you can very much get that sense that what's about to happen is something that we chose before we're born, and we're all here and we're about to do it again.
I like that. I love the adventure feeling of that. Whether it's, it also teaches us to be with it, like to be in the program or whatever. Yeah. Or to feel
and
you
I think
can
you're
do
right
something.
I think you're right about the question of the 60s, and trying to, in a way, come out again myself. I felt that the thing that I could perhaps do best of all would be to go back to the 60s. The 60s really did happen. And, I wound up being the coordinator of the largest anti-war and civil rights coalition of that time. It was actually the largest anti-war movement in American history.
Wow.
And what we did was just phenomenal. I mean, we started off as students, students in the North and students in the South, college students. And we basically just, to the chagrin of our parents, we left society and just all band together to go out and change the world. And, it's what started in the South is small but potent sit-ins. What actually started the 60s movement were just four freshmen Black students who just nervously, walked across the street, having known all that night they were about to do this. They went into an all-white Woolworths lunch counter. Four people, freshmen too, and just sat at the stools and basically made it clear that they were not going to leave until they were served lunch. And everybody was here, everybody was ready, but we were hardly aware that we were a movement about to change the world. But we saw them, and they were on television. Demonstrations started to appear with white mobs outside the Woolworths counter. They were pushed, shoved, heckled. Some had cigarettes ground out on the back of their neck.
Wow.
We watched it on television, and it just fired us up. I mean, we were like, 300,000 to 500,000 strong in the first 3 to 4 months. And then we just went on to grow into millions of people. When the movement went from civil rights to civil rights plus anti-war movement, we took an issue that was forbidden. My parents absolutely believed that you had to support the government in a time of war. I mean, it was just the way it was.
Canadian. So my parents as well.
To have people stand up and oppose a war being conducted by their own government was just unheard of. And yet we won that battle. I went to Chicago to organize a demonstration at the Democratic Convention in the summer of 1968.
Convention.
Exactly. I remember, before the public opinion polls came out and showed that a majority of the American people supported the war in Vietnam before that demonstration. After that demonstration, which was watched by more people on television than watched the first man landing on the moon, the majority of the country in Gallup polls showed had shifted to oppose the war in Vietnam.
Well, you know, we were Canadian, and my mother was and father were appalled that we were very active in this peace movement. And she watched the Democratic Convention, and she turned entirely. And this is in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so tell exactly, people a little bit about it. What happened? It developed riots or... Tell people what happened.
Well, we started out with the idea that our coalition would bring 500,000 people to the Democratic Convention on the night of the nomination. And we believed that because there was no opposition to the war at that point except us. Mm. There was no one willing to stand up to President Johnson, who was, you know, a sitting president conducting the war. And so it seemed at the time that we were the only opposition. And so we prepared ourselves. We had done the first demonstration was 150,000 people at the Pentagon. I felt confident that we were preparing for 500,000 people in Chicago. And what happened was the mayor of the city, Mayor Daley, made the decision to not grant permits for the demonstration. You know, permits are a requirement, even though we have the First Amendment. The city has a right to basically grant a permit to determine a route. So it was unheard of not to grant permits. The Johnson administration, Ramsey Clark, who was the attorney general, was just horrified by this decision by the mayor. He sent their attorney general sent his right-hand person out to meet with me to, you know, try to understand why this was happening, you know, and then went into the meeting with the mayor and, you know, basically mentioned my name, and the mayor's, you know, neck just turned crimson red, and he went on a tirade about never granting permits. So with the decision of the local officials to not grant permits that made us, you know, move into another situation. So rather than 500,000 people, you know, most adults just felt it was too intimidating to come to Chicago. You could lose your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could certainly be clubbed and beaten and gassed. So
just for information,
people,
who was being set up? Who were the candidates for the Democrats?
Well, during the time that we thought 500,000 people were coming, Gene McCarthy, who was a senator, made the decision to run against Johnson in what was then the first primary in New Hampshire.
Oh.
And he won 42% of the vote.
Wow.
Johnson won the election with 49%, but 42% against a sitting president was just electric, you know, and so it was very similar to the Bernie Sanders movement today.
Wow.
I mean, students just galvanized around McCarthy, and basically suddenly there was a real opposition. And that opposition was so powerful that it opened the doorway for Bobby Kennedy, who was the brother of the president, John Kennedy, to make the decision himself to run for president. And then after he made that decision, Governor McGovern came in and ran too. And so suddenly there was, you know, a situation where the possibility to end the war through an election was real. I mean, it could happen.
Wow.
And so we went into Chicago with the inside the convention, having the convention completely split between kind of what was called the law and order element, represented by Mayor Daley, and the anti-war delegations, which were gigantic, but not a majority.
Was that where the group of seven was, the Chicago Seven? Is that you guys leading that?
So I was the coordinator of that demonstration in Chicago. And after the event was over, a national commission made the decision to study who caused the riots in Chicago.
Ah.
You know, they reviewed FBI tapes, and, you know, they had over 200 agents, investigators, you know. They published a report that went right to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list called the Walker Report. it described the whole event as a police riot. It was one of the better accounts ever of my efforts in Chicago.
Great.
And it clearly made it the case that, you know, this was coming from the mayor. Not granting permits was the reason for this happening. And so the attorney general with this came out and, you know, argued against any indictments. That what who should be indicted, he said, was the hundreds of policemen who rioted. And so with the Democratic Party completely humiliated by what happened in Chicago and a two-party system, and the only other choice was a Republican whose name was Richard Nixon.
Okay.
Nixon won the election. So Nixon was not about to go down in history as losing a war, and he directed his attorney general to basically indict the so-called leaders of the Chicago event. And so eight of us actually were indicted. Five were perhaps relevant as organizers to the event. Bobby Seale was the chairman of the Black Panther Party at the time. He had come to Chicago and made two speeches only and left. That's all. It was his entire environment. And for those two speeches, he was now facing 10 years in prison.
Oh, my gosh.
And then there were two university professors who were, you know, against the war, and they were indicted. It seemed to me to intimidate, you know, university professors to not support our anti-war movement on college campuses. So we were eight people who basically went to trial. During the trial, the attorney for Bobby Seale had to undergo gallbladder. He couldn't get the judge to give him a continuance, and so Bobby was without representation and made the decision to defend himself. So someone on the witness stand would mention Bobby's name, and Bobby would stand up to cross-examine the witness. There were, I don't know, generally 35 marshals in the courtroom surrounding the walls. I mean, they were not little guys. They reminded me of a Super Bowl football huddle. They were pretty serious dudes. And so the judge would order the marshals to put Bobby into his seat, which was kind of martial code, I think, for use extreme force. So it was very intense, and this is in front of a jury.
Wow.
Bobby would be slammed into his chair.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, but Bobby kept persisting and, you know, calling out and wanting to cross-examine. So eventually what happened was I was just sitting in courtroom one day, and I looked up, and here came Bobby chained and gagged in his chair.
Oh, really?
He had a pressure bandage around his head with gauze in his mouth so he couldn't call out, you know.
What did you do? Did you just sit there? Were you
well, it was a 4 or 5 day drama. Like, you know, I mean, the first thing I would say was Bobby himself was just breathtaking. I mean, you no matter how intense the bandage got, which it got worse and worse as the days went on, Bobby could always be heard. You are the member constitution here to these muffled garments. That was just hysterical, you know. And it was very intense. I mean, I can see blood coming out of his lips, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was an intense ordeal for him every morning. They would shove this gauze into his mouth before the pressure bandage would go on. And
oh,
so,
my gosh.
You know, so eventually it just became, I mean, so suddenly you had a black man chained and gagged with artist renditions of this going out all over the world. And Bobby, you know, couldn't be gagged. I mean, he was being heard in Africa, Europe, Asia.
Wow.
I mean, the whole world. I mean, he just became a world symbol for a black man.
Was he the only black man in that group? Was he the only?
Yes.
Okay.
He was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of this amazing event, Bobby Seale, the judge decided he had to sever Bobby from the trial. And so that's when the media decided that we were the Chicago 7.
Hmm.
We always think of ourselves as the Chicago 8, but, you know,
good, yeah.
The name that is stuck when you Google us today, it's the Chicago 7. Because Bobby was severed from the trial.
Wow. Well, did you end up in jail for a while?
Well, it was interesting. After it was all over, the jury, there were two charges against us, and the jury was pretty much like the country. It was just deeply polarized and divided and could not make a decision. I mean, we had our fans and supporters on the jury.
I'll betcha.
As we had in the country.
I'll betcha.
And so the judge just went ballistic over the idea that the jury was not going to, was deadlocked, you know, and so ordered the jury to go back and find a way to make a decision. There's too much time and too much money, he said, had been spent to be deadlocked. You know, well, the jurors had been sequestered, you know, they had their family for 5.5 months. They were in a hotel room, and they concluded their only option was to compromise. And so they found us guilty of one charge and innocent of the other. And then while the jury was deliberating, we were sentenced for contempt of court. I was sentenced to 2.5 years for contempt of court.
Oh, wow.
And my lawyer, Bill Kunstler, was sentenced to 4 years of contempt of court.
Your lawyer?
For defending us in court.
Oh,
yeah, the lawyer.
My gosh. Wow.
So that was what we were charged with. So then we went to Cook County Jail that day, and it was really interesting. I mean, I went into this. We were separated at that point. We, you know, individually, I went into a cell block with maybe 300 people. Almost everyone was black. There was a young guy, maybe 22 years old, who came up to me and, you know, was helpful, wanted to show me where the bunk beds were and stuff, asked me my name. I told him Rennie. He said, "Well, Rennie who?" So with that, I mean, I was lifted onto a table and absolutely screaming pandemonium. I mean, the whole cell block is just riveted on the trial.
Oh, good.
And at the same time, there were 20,000 people outside screaming for our release.
Good.
And that night, 10,000 community just erupted all across the United States.
Wow.
And
well, did you have a half a million at the convention itself? Did you achieve that number?
No, the numbers obviously fell off with the threat of violence. So
right,
adults
yeah.
couldn't come. We did have one at the very last minute. They granted us a permit. It was far from the convention, but it was downtown Chicago, and I decided to accept the permit because I knew there were people in Chicago who were adult, over 30, let's say, who wanted to come but just wouldn't come with police matching people. So we went ahead. Then what happened was a teenager actually lowered the flag in the park to half mast. He testified later in our trial that it was a sign of international distress. And the police just went crazy over that. They, you know, they broke through and, you know, ran into the crowd and beat this teenager. And
oh, really?
Him.
Oh, wow.
I put up a marshal's line to kind of secure our perimeter and called to the police that, you know, that we have a permit and we're legal and, you know, please pull back. And that just that was like kerosene on a fire.
Wow. It was a real revolution, right? So the police charged again?
It was intense, yeah. I mean, you know, on that one, I was hit myself, you know, on the head and beat with on the back, trying to, you know, crawl along the ground. There was a little chain link fence in the park, and I came to that fence, and it gave me just 3 seconds to get under the fence, stand up, and get into the crowd. And I did pass out from that. And so, you know, there was one more story I'll share just because it was so amazing. You know, I went to the hospital to get stitches, and the police were just beside themselves that I hadn't been arrested. So they did a room by room search of the hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
And the nurses and the doctors, I mean, these were county employees. I mean, they worked for the city, you know, and there was a group of nurses who put me on a rolling bed, covered me with a sheet, and moved me from room to room, hiding from the police, risking their careers and jail, really, till I could get to an exit and get out. So I myself was never arrested in Chicago.
Wow. So you didn't actually have to serve time.
We, what happened was we, when we went in, our staff was raising bail, and I realized that, I mean, the guy that, you know, took me to my bunk bed, he had been in Cook County Jail for 9 months because he couldn't post $100 bail.
Oh my gosh.
9 months. Oh. Okay. Just for a lack of $100.
Oh.
And as I talked to the inmates, I mean, it was, most of them had a similar story. So there was a guard that was just enthralled with the Chicago Seven. So I said, well, listen, go ask everyone. Let's just stay in jail and raise money and bring the whole jail out when we come.
So, little troublemaker. How wonderful.
So anyway, that's what we did. We stayed in jail for 2 weeks and raised money. And then when we came out, we were able to. I don't know that we got everyone, but we brought quite a crew out with us, you know, which is really just a beautiful way to end that whole trial.
Was a wonderful story. Tell people the end of the Vietnam War. There was a huge impact on that, wasn't there?
There was. You know, what happened was, I think the decisive event was, what happened was in the spring of 1970, Nixon made a decision to invade Cambodia, and that triggered a nationwide student strike. Millennials today, many of them don't know that this happened. You know, like a millennial today in college probably does not realize that their own college completely shut down in the spring of 1970 to oppose the war in Vietnam.
Wow.
And I mean, 90% of the universities just shut down.
Wow.
And hundreds of, you know, over 100,000 people marched on Washington. But after that event, it was just, you know, students didn't know what more could be done. And the movement had this sense of cooling down. In fact, Time magazine came out with a cover story saying the cooling of America.
Wow.
And I went to the coalition because I was aware of what was happening with Chemical Agent Orange. I mean, deformities were the concern of Vietnamese and French scientists.
Wow.
And so I felt we needed to move to a new level, civil disobedience in Washington. And the coalition didn't have a problem with the tactic, but just no one believed it was possible. So I decided to just go test the waters. And I went to, you know, a few colleges, and where I went, everybody was still there. Everybody was just wanting to know what was happening. So, I mean, my first talk was at Brown University. The students organizers told me, well, they didn't think anybody would turn out. 5,000 people were in the room.
Wow.
Screaming, you know?
That's wonderful.
So,
huh?
I know, it was really amazing. And after a few talks, I realized, well, this is really, I mean, we actually put together the most complicated, impactful event in the history of movements that in the spring of 1971. It started off with 250,000 people at the Capitol. Then it moved to hundreds of Vietnam veterans turning their medals, Bronze Stars, Purple Hearts that they had won in Vietnam back to Congress.
Wow.
And then when I stepped out to speak to people who were ready to be arrested, 100,000 people
were
in front of me, you know. And so it was the largest arrest in American history.
Wow. And the music was tremendous. I'm thinking, something happened in here. Remember all that music that
yeah.
came up? Wow.
There's no doubt about it. Yeah, the music of the 60s was a big factor, no doubt about it.
Oh, it really helped.
But anyway, that event in Washington, most historians now would say it really was what caused the Nixon White House to decide to sign the Paris Peace Talks in 1973.
Wonderful.
Which they did. They continue to hang on, you know, and try to find a way to get around the agreement that they had signed. And at the end of the day, it was really the Vietnamese themselves who just literally overran South Vietnam and overran Saigon. And so the military, the U.S. military, which was understood to be the greatest military force in history, was defeated by a guerrilla army in Vietnam. It's another It was another amazing, you know, event.
And then what about Cambodia? It carried on for a while, didn't it?
Well, Cambodia just was a disaster. I mean, the Saigon government escaped into Cambodia and camped out in the jungles for 7 years. But the Khmer Rouge, which was sort of grew up because of the invasion by Nixon, wound up, you know, executing over 2 million Cambodians.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just
that
a horror.
Terrible.
That Saigon army actually was the one that had the ability and made the decision to militarily defeat the Khmer Rouge, and they did.
Wow.
But it was just one of the really sad stories of that whole thing with the Cambodian, what happened in Cambodia.
Wow. Well, let's go back to what happened with Rennie at the end of this absolutely almost exotic protest in the hands of students, which I think is very inspiring in itself. What happened to you? Because a lot of us at the end of the 60s went off to do things, to understand ourselves, to figure out what's up, what is power, what is truth, right?
Well, I think it's one of the unknown or kind of forgotten parts, the transition of a movement back into society when things do cool down. For the 60s, it was really a time of back to nature, or going to India to learn a meditation, or just being quiet. It was quite interesting, really. I mean, people learned survival skills, carried water from their own well, just developed some self-sufficiency know-how, learned about the intelligence of nature. These are skill sets that are going to be indispensable for the time that is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I call the whole period you're describing the quiet revolution. It was unexpected, really, but political activists like myself went through a period of quiet. I wound up being in the bottom of the Grand Canyon for, well, in and out, but mostly there for 4 years.
Wow. Just to be quiet.
And so, just to listen, you know, it's kind of a new concept for me, listening, but I did. And I would say that all of my views about what's coming and what's up for today, which I don't really wear on my sleeve particularly, but it motivates me, does, you know, really came from that beautiful time with the earth. You know, in the depths of a canyon that just where I could feel the earth, you know.
And to understand the power or the truth of life, is that it, would you say, a meditation?
No, I would say more the ability to quiet the brain and access knowingness.
Okay.
We all have it. We get little glimpses of intuition, then generally tend to forget to follow it, and then kind of look back and wish that we had.
But this is awakening, isn't that what you're describing? Awakening, isn't it?
Well, you could call it that. I mean, I would say that the real purpose, if you want to call it that, of human beings on Earth is a journey to evolve. And so the ability to learn more about ourselves. I mean, we have, for example, 14 senses, not five. But what are they, and where are they located, and how do you turn them on? These are things that are coming up for the present generation. So the ability to basically create a new human being out of ourselves is going to be a part of what this current time offers. And if you really look around, I mean, at the, say, today's movement, which is, I say it's starting its engines right now, you can see it in lots of little ways. And I, you know, I mean, it's not the water protectors at the Sioux Reservation may be remembered as the ignition point.
Okay.
I personally think that the ignition for our movement, like we had the ignition of the four black students, I believe the ignition for the movement today, it's actually Donald Trump.
Oh, really? Okay.
Recognizing that there are many millions of people that are enthralled with him because he talked to their forgotten issues and addresses their real problems as he sees it. But, you know, if you really, you know, anyone listening, okay, you can see that there's a real desire to roll back the clock on, you know, racial and gender equality. And there's not going to be an attack on extreme wealth stratification. There's an embracement of money in politics, contrary to what's being said. So when the first abrupt move is made, like deporting Dreamers or deciding that Muslims have to be registered, watch and see. I mean, it's just everything that Trump does in the attack of core values is going to expand and strengthen our movement. And so I just say, watch and see. It's not going to be. It's true that when there is no movement and repression comes in, like the 1950s, it can be a scary time.
Yeah.
But today, everybody thinks the story of our time right now is the election of Donald Trump. I don't agree. I say the story of our time is ourselves. The story of our time is a movement to change the world, mm-hmm. and it's already igniting. And it's
so what you're saying is people are getting to their own personal power as opposed to being a product of these systems. Is that what you're saying?
No, movement is about taking personal power and uniting.
Okay.
So it's not just about your individual ability to basically create your own reality. That's a part of it. But in our case, the ignition is going to be standing up for American, we the people, traditional core values of the country. That's how we'll start. But that's not how we'll end. Okay, the issue that's going to make us global and make us the greatest movement in the history of the world is what's coming. Trump will get us started, but it's climate change, sea levels rising, mm-hmm. ecosystems collapsing. Our oceans are dying. Our topsoil is blowing away. Our world is in a crisis that society has not grasped. Mm-hmm. And it's not any, I mean, many people are part of a conversation that understands civilization's unsustainable, humanity actually is in trouble. But right now the conversation is, you know, it's a part of humanity. It's a segment of humanity that's going to now grow to include every human being on Earth. Everyone is going to see through their own experience. No one's going to go out and persuade science deniers that they're wrong. But when events knock on their own door, that's how they'll get the picture. And so the movement that is coming is going to basically explode around how can human beings live on this earth? How can we create a new way of living that aligns with the planet and supports life on the planet rather than destroying the planet? And I believe the same thing happened in all other movements too. You start out with multiple issues and then events drive you into some unity. Mm. And so for us, our events were civil rights and ending the war in Vietnam. The events for our time will be starting off with defending core values, but moving into defending the human race itself.
Wow. So you have several ways in which we're confined by the coming crunch, as you call it. I mean, it's economic as well, right? And the economic is dependent on systems that are not going to last, right?
Yeah, I would say that it's, you know, I don't know. You know, I a little bit for me, I say we can all wait and see. You know, I appreciate when I can meet a person who doesn't need to have their door blown down by the storm that's coming to figure it out, you know? And so there actually is a very large segment right now that doesn't believe everything is fine and that society is normal and there's no problem. I mean, I don't mean of course everybody sees there's problems, but the civilization, okay, the thing that we depend upon that lets us, you know, enjoy our meals and the way we live, okay, that is what's being threatened right now. And that is not registering in civilization or society, but there is a segment of humanity that, a very large segment, that is figuring it out. And that segment is what I call the new humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And the new humanity is going to write a new human story. And they're going to basically be called the greatest generation because they had the foresight to set up and get ready before the hysteria hit. And so everything that you think and your readers and your listeners believe to be the way it is, okay, civilization itself, okay, is basically under threat right now.
Right.
And so I don't really see Trump is to me just a blip in the, I mean, Trump is actually going to create the conditions for us to be the new leadership on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really get intimidated by him at all, really. I'm just,
that's a better way to look at it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we can look at it like Trump is the whole problem and everybody, let's go into fear and crisis, you know, over what he's doing with his new cabinet and so forth. But I understand people do that, but I would also encourage, you know, your listeners to just look up and look out at the edge of the horizon to see what's actually coming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a study by scientists from multiple nations that has just looked at all the major bays in the world over the last 1,000 years. And it's just concluded that all ocean life will be over by 2048.
Wow.
Okay. Now,
yeah, really.
Why wouldn't that be on the front page of every paper?
And why wouldn't it be, for heaven's sakes? And global, the oceans have risen in temperature, have they not? Hugely.
Yeah, it's all, you know, if you read the science, which I have, okay, you might conclude that, hey, we can kick the can down the road. We really actually have until the end of the century before Greenland melts and ocean levels rise consequently by 20 feet. But then there's these studies that are showing these giant channels have just opened up in the ice of Greenland, and ice water is pouring down through these channels, creating a water lubricant underneath the entire thing so it can move.
Wow.
And so everywhere you look in the science, the conventional science is being challenged. Everything is speeding up. Here's my view on the whole thing. I think what we have is 12 to 15 years to set up and get ready.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the pivot point right now. This is not something way down the road that anyone can ignore. Now, people will. I mean, until the storm blows down your own door, most people won't. It's just, if you look at the studies of history, like, probably the best really is Arnold Toynbee. He studied these questions. You know, what causes a society just to collapse?
Mm-hmm.
Civilization not to unwind. I mean, because it has happened in the past. And so he made a list of all the features that have caused societies to collapse in the past. Of course, every single one of them is present majorly today. And the number one reason always to Toynbee is fear and divide. It's the inability of a government to make any decision at all because of partisan gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely the number one reason the society has collapsed. So anyone who's thinking that the electoral process is the way out, or that institutions are going to come up with technologies that are going to solve the problem, or even that we have time on climate change.
Right.
You know, I mean, I mean, that's the prevailing assumption that, well, we still have time on climate change. And so that's fine. You know, I really, I have no need to pick arguments with people like that, but there is a very big segment of scientists who understand that we've completely run out of time. We have no more time at all.
Mm.
It isn't about changing the climate. All we can do now is to get ready for what's coming.
Right.
That's it, you know? And so what we need is a completely new economic model. What absolutely has to end is the commitment and the pledge of every nation on earth to grow and consume.
Right.
The fundamental economic model of humanity itself is completely sideways with the future of our own species.
Wow. So what do you suggest? What do you suggest we do? Because I saw that up and coming there, you're leading a meditation, right? What do you suggest we do to ready ourselves or to I want to be part of a wave of consciousness that's moving through the species, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing to do is to realize that our movement, today's movement, is going to naturally fall into three categories. And so as people figure it out and realize that we really are in trouble.
Right.
And our whole civilization is unsustainable. And it's not going to be because anybody made the argument. It's going to be because of events. Okay, what's going to happen is one group of people is going to try to put insulation in their attic and get sustainable and recycle right in their home and their business. Okay, conscious business is going to emerge. You know, I call it the transition movement. It already exists. It's all around the world, but it's going to grow into a major quadrant of our movement. The second is going to be what Bernie Sanders would call the political revolution.
Okay.
And this will be more like the 60s. You know, it's not going to just be that people protest wealth stratification and, you know, police brutality. These things will happen, but industries that basically do not create a new way of living, like the petroleum industry, the chemical industry, the agriculture industry, the political revolution is going to close down industries.
Right.
I mean, it's going to be much bigger than the 60s. But then there's this third segment that you're speaking about that really has its roots in that quiet revolution that came right at the end of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a group of people that basically do believe in the Gandhi proposition that we have to be the change that changes the world. They're aware that their own perception is powerful to what they experience in the outside world. Some have actually discovered that whatever they fear is what they actually experience.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they condemn is also what they experience, you know? So this is going to be the group that's going to set up the new way of living. This is going to be the group that's going to create the new economic model. It's going to be community-based. And some of these inventions that right now are in the basements of inventors and they're going to be brought out. We're going to see free energy. We're going to see the ability to create a new economic model at a local level where you go onto the land and it's not hardship and struggle. People actually live and thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And then by committing ourselves to just a set of basic principles like respect and collaboration and love and joy, you know, and having some tools to do that that we can really agree on. These communities are going to be awesome. I mean, they're going to basically feed the people who live in the community, and they're going to be able to basically create an option for every region that's in utter no option despair. So any place that's struggling to cope will start to look to us to come and set up and basically create a new way of living right where they are.
How
and
wonderful.
All of this is basically is in the next 12 to 15 year window. If we don't do it now, then the human race, I don't know that there'll be a human being on Earth at the end of the century.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I want to do something that's a little bit more, sentimental. You met John Lennon, right? Do you feel like he was imbued already with that kind of consciousness?
Well, he was trying. he was actually the first person. I mean, I would say that who was kind of kicking his pants a bit was Yoko Ono.
Oh, okay.
So Yoko kind of pushed him, and he basically was coming around to the idea that if you could change yourself, you could change the world, that your thoughts really were important.
Imagine.
And, you know, he put up billboards that, you know, had that theme on it. People didn't quite know what they meant exactly. You know, you can end the war if you want to, things like that. You know? That's where he was coming from, you know. And so, you know, I mean, this was John Lennon. He was joining the movement. He was my new partner. I wasn't about to take him on, but I had to say, in those days, I kind of scratched my head a little bit and said, well, that's kind of interesting, John. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. You know, like that. Now, when looking back, I would say that John was correct. But
he's one of the lights that came through that became very famous. I mean, there were a lot of
he certainly did, you know. Yeah. And to his credit, at the end, he did come out and he did join our movement. He came with me and partnered up with me we were going to do travel together to 42 cities mm-hmm. and end up at the Republican convention with 1 million people.
Wow.
With John Lennon making that declaration. So,
and did he die before that happened?
I don't know. I think that's a more metaphysical question that I why he died.
Yeah. No, I just wondered if he died before that happened.
Oh no, we got to the first event, which was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was sold out in 45 minutes. Stevie Wonder performed with John. It was focused on a person who was in prison because he had been arrested by a police for 2 marijuana joints. He was in jail for 10 years.
My gosh.
We threatened to shut down the city of Detroit if he wasn't released in 2 weeks.
Oh, good for you.
And he was released in 5 days. After having 3 appeals denied, he was let go.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to end this, but I'd sure like to talk to you again. But if we fast forward from that particular story, do you think people are able these days or are already doing this kind of protest? Because people are being jailed for stupid things now, aren't they? Or dominant things.
No, I think it's better than that. I think a movement has just ignited.
Okay. Good.
I think we're underway right now.
Oh, do you promise, Rennie?
I promise, yeah.
Oh,
it's already begun.
Isn't that
and
wonderful?
And basically now events will basically ignite us.
Yay!
So the events are coming, you know. I mean, what happened in the North Dakota was pretty breathtaking, and especially to see the support that generated so quickly, mm-hmm. not just in this country, but worldwide.
Worldwide,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's not over yet, actually. It's, you know, I mean, I'd love to believe that the decision to not grant the permits by the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps, would hold up, but I'll be shocked if that holds up.
I think they're playing with us.
I feel much more confident that the pipeline will go through.
But I have to end this talk, unfortunately. So I want you to tell people about your book, and we'd like you to come back and talk again, if you will. But tell.
I know, and I wanted Kirsten to join us, too. Oh, no.
Well, we're going to get her back as well. I promise.
Okay.
Or at least I'm going my way.
I decided to say everything that I've said here, I've decided to present in a book. And then I realized that I couldn't do it in one book. So with Kirsten, I'm writing a trilogy.
Great.
So the first book basically goes back to the 60s to explain how we did it then in order to do it again today.
Good.
And the second book called Humanity at the Crossroads. All the books are called The New Humanity, A Movement to Change the World.
Great.
And the second book basically lays out in very stark terms what the science actually says, okay, and why time has run out, what our real situation is, and what we can do about it. And then the third book, called The Rise of Ilion, is about building a new nation on Earth based on a new way of living that basically re-scripts the entire way we live.
Wonderful.
A new human story.
Wonderful. Well, also, I believe you're having a book on how to do peaceful demonstration or to
Well, but part of the book, we decided to take some stories from the book, first book, and turn it into a little manual. It's a guide for people that want to organize protests and movements.
Wow.
And we really like it. I mean, it's for a new movement. I mean, you know, we've been through this, you know, the issue of permits, you know, and what about violence and nonviolence? What, you know, is that relevant today? And just basic things that are essential to a successful movement that's drawn from, you know, what worked in the past and what really was a disaster in the past is all brought into a little manual that we're giving away on a website called newhumanitybook.com.
New Humanity Book. And I have to say thank you, thank you, thank you. And please come on again. This is Rennie Davis, who is speaking to us as a true paradigm shifter, encouraging us also to be paradigm shifters and to join one another in that. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying, let me know what you think. VeronicaEntwistle.com, and the podcast will be available there. And I hope to hear back from you. Much love to everyone.